Welcome to the show that gets Christians thinking about faith and politics. Get ready to challenge the status quo, expand your imagination, and tackle controversy head on. Let's stand together at the intersection of faith and freedom. It's time for the Libertarian Christian Podcast.
Welcome to another episode of the Libertarian Christian Podcast, a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute. I'm your host, Cody Cook, and I have John Wrench with me. Despite his name, John Wrench is not a cop who plays by his own rules or the greedy hero of a 70s blaxploitation film, but the assistant director of the Center for Judicial Engagement at the Institute for Justice. And I have him here to talk about his work with the Institute for Justice, their fantastic podcast, Bound by Oath, which I think they just wrapped up their third season, and the surprising and fascinating history of the 14th Amendment. And as libertarians, you'll be, I think, shocked and really fascinated by this story. So, John, thank you for being here.
Of course, Cody. It's great to be on the podcast.
Yeah, and I don't really know you that well yet, so I don't know if that blaxploitation joke was above the line or not.
I think everything in your intro was great.
Spot on. Okay, good. It's a pretty cool name, I have to say. Like, I think if my name was John Wrench, I'd feel like I'd have to be some sort of an action hero.
I appreciate it. There's not a lot of us walking around. There's a lot of Johns, but not a lot of Wrenches. So
yeah. Okay, so Institute for Justice. I'm trying to think when I first heard about them that you guys do ads in Reason magazine, so I've seen them there.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
But I think what really got me interested, you got some great videos on YouTube and stuff as well. Mm. But I think it was the podcast Bound by Oath. And the first season really focused on the 14th Amendment. But Institute for Justice is not just sort of a kind of a public facing kind of information clearinghouse. You guys sort of do work in the field of the legal field, I guess I'd say. So what does the Institute for Justice do, and what kind of work have you done with them?
Yeah, so the Institute for Justice is a nonprofit public interest law firm that protects people's constitutional rights against government abuse. So we were founded in 1991. Our headquarters is in Arlington, Virginia, and we also have state offices throughout the country in Miami, Austin, Phoenix, and Seattle. And our litigation is focused on what we call our four pillars, which are property rights, First Amendment, educational choice, and economic liberty. And we also have several litigation projects. There's quite a number of them now. They're immunity and accountability, forfeiture, Fourth Amendment, food freedom, and our most recent is zoning justice. And we're currently litigating, I think, 110 cases in 37 states and DC. I came to IJ straight out of law school through IJ's two-year litigation fellowship. I litigated at IJ for about 5 years across a good chunk of our litigation areas, free speech, in particular property rights, and Fourth Amendment. And as you noted, I recently became the assistant director of IJ's Center for Judicial Engagement, which produces the Bound by Oath podcast that you mentioned. We do educational work. We also produce scholarship and our short circuit newsletter.
So, and the headquarters in Arlington, is that to be close to the belly of the beast, so to speak?
Yes, it is. It actually used to be in the belly of the beast, and then it moved out of DC just across the river. So we can still kind of keep an eye on it without being in it.
Yeah, be independent, but also, yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, so, okay, so as I mentioned before, one of my favorite things that IJ, the Institute for Justice, does is produce a podcast called Bound by Oath. And I jumped early on in season one, which was all about the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. And for those who don't have it in their head, I'll go ahead and read it. It was adopted in 1868, and it reads, "No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of the citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny any person to any person within its jurisdiction, the equal protection of the laws." So I want LCEI podcast listeners to check out every episode of Bound by Oath. So I'm only going to scratch the surface on some of the great content that's there. But for our purposes, I want to cover some of the broad strokes and a few of the most interesting details. So I'll start with this question. What was the original intent of the 14th Amendment, and what issues was it meant to address at the time that it was adopted?
Yeah, so to understand the intent of the 14th Amendment, it is a little helpful to give kind of a brief background on the Civil War. At least we're going to jump into kind of the middle of the Civil War and the 13th Amendment. So in January of 1863, so this is in the middle of the Civil War, President Lincoln relies on his wartime powers to issue the Emancipation Proclamation, which frees more than 3.5 million enslaved Black people in the Southern secessionist states. But there were concerns that the proclamation wouldn't be sufficient to permanently eradicate slavery. There was concern that there would actually need to be some kind of constitutional amendment for that change to be permanent. So in January of 1865, the war is still going on. Congress had passed the 13th Amendment, which would abolish slavery and give Congress the power to enforce the article by, quote, appropriate legislation. Lincoln is then assassinated in April of that year. The war ends in May. And then the states ratify the 13th Amendment in December of 1865. But despite being emancipated by the 13th Amendment, newly freed Blacks, which make up 1/8 of the South's population at that time, were now subject to just other forms of abuses. So for example, Southern states enacted what were called the Black Codes, which used things like vagrancy laws to literally round up freedmen as, quote, vagrants and contract them out often back to their former masters as workers. And also the Black Codes often restricted freedmen's ability to work in certain occupations. They restricted their rights to own a property, to participate in public spaces and things like that. So although the 13th Amendment had emancipated them from slavery, freedmen in the South had found themselves subjected to just a host of new abuses at the hands of local and state government. Now, if someone's hearing this today, they might think, what about the Bill of Rights? Why not sue to stop states and local governments from infringing on people's constitutional rights? But this is the problem. The rights protected in the U.S. Constitution, what we refer to as the Bill of Rights, was designed originally to be a restriction only on the federal government. So the U.S. Constitution was not designed to prevent states from violating your federal rights. The expectation was that each state's constitution, which they all include declarations of rights or Bill of Rights, the expectation was that those state constitutions would protect peoples from being abused by their states. So there was no real way for newly freed Blacks to go to court and say, hey, this state or local government isn't protecting, or this state or local government is violating my federal rights. It just didn't exist. There wasn't a mechanism for that. And that's where the 14th Amendment comes in. The 14th Amendment was designed to prohibit the states from violating rights protected under the U.S. Constitution. And the 14th Amendment, which you just read, Cody, is, it's actually quite complex for an amendment. It's five separate sections, all of which began as independent amendments. And they're eventually compressed into this one big amendment. And section one, which is the one that you read, is the part that's understood to have incorporated the Bill of Rights in the U.S. Constitution against the states.
And my understanding is, so the idea was that not just the Bill of Rights, but also sort of countless unenumerated rights that were sort of understood to belong to individuals would now be protected by the federal government against state intervention. So, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And that's a change that kind of happens later, is this distinction between enumerated rights in the Bill of Rights as being kind of real rights and there being, you know, some other unenumerated rights that are maybe less real. That distinction really didn't exist at this time. So the view was just that the 14th Amendment would incorporate all of that against the states.
Got it. Well, and what's interesting, I mean, to me, you know, at this day and age, libertarians, conservatives, they generally hold that directing power down towards states and localities is a better protection for individual rights. But at least in this regard, the 14th Amendment really highlighted an important counterpoint to that notion, which is that, you know, in this case, the federal government was more interested in protecting the individual rights of Black Americans than many states and local governments were, right?
Yeah, I think that that's true. And I would note that the nation's founders, they held that same view as well, that our constitutional system does assume that a top-down, distant, monolithic government is an extreme threat to individual rights. That's exactly the kind of government that the founders had just fought a war to escape from. but slavery posed a problem to our constitutional system as it was before the 14th Amendment. What happens when states or local governments actively abuse individuals on the ground that they are, quote, an inferior race? What happens when a state or local government abdicates its duty to protect people's rights? And slavery and Reconstruction, they illustrated that the abuse can and does come at the hands of local and state officials.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. So the 14th Amendment required that, quote, no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. So how about this particular clause, the privileges or immunities clause? What was that understood to mean at the time that it was drafted? What did the authors of the 14th Amendment mean by privileges or immunities?
Yeah, so there's two things that kind of help us understand the intended scope of the privileges or immunities clause. First, one of the reasons that the 14th Amendment was enacted in the first place was to provide more solid legal footing to the Civil Rights Act of 1866. The Civil Rights Act had given citizens the right to make and enforce contracts, to sue, to be parties, to give evidence, to purchase, lease, and sell real and personal property. So Congress certainly intended the Privileges or Immunities Clause to protect those rights. The second thing that helps us to understand the original intention of the Privileges or Immunities Clause are statements by the designated floor sponsor for the 14th Amendment, the person who is on the floor explaining the amendment's purpose. His name was Jacob Howard. He was a Michigan senator. And he gave a lengthy speech about the meaning of the Privileges or Immunities Clause. And during that speech, he references this 1823 case called Corfield versus Coryell. And that case, Corfield, was about the scope of another provision of the Constitution, the Privileges and Immunities Clause, which of course is one of the most confusing things in the world, that there is a privileges and immunities, privileges or immunities. But in this speech, he's referencing the Privileges and Immunities Clause, which is part of Article 4, Section 2, of the Constitution. And Senator Howard quotes at length from the Corfield decision. And the judge in Corfield had named a non-exhaustive list of fundamental rights that fall under privileges or immunity. So I'm gonna quote from it because it's quite interesting, especially because of what comes after. So protection by the government, the enjoyment of life and liberty, with the right to acquire and possess property of every kind, to pursue and obtain happiness and safety, subject to the restraints as government may justly prescribe for the general good of the whole, the right of a citizen of one state to pass through or to reside in another for purposes of trade, agriculture, professional pursuits, or otherwise, to claim the benefit of the writ of habeas corpus, to institute and maintain actions of any kind in the courts of the state, to take, hold, and dispose of property, an exemption from higher taxes or impositions paid by other citizens of the state. These and many others which might be mentioned are, strictly speaking, privileges or immunities, end quote. So this decision has a lengthy list of things that are privileges or immunities. And in that same case, the judge says it would actually be more tedious than difficult to list all of the privileges or immunities. So like you said before, the whole idea was that the 14th Amendment would be incorporating all of these enumerated and unenumerated rights. So by citing and importing the reasoning from that older decision, we know that the Privileges or Immunities Clause was intended to at least encompass those rights as well.
Gotcha. So the 14th Amendment was clearly designed to protect the individual rights of Black Americans and other Americans. So that must have settled the issue of civil rights for good, right? The states extended full rights of citizenship to people of color. The courts protected those rights whenever they were being violated, right?
Yeah, we would have a very different history if that were true. Unfortunately, not. I mean, the beginning to this going downhill very quickly is a really important Supreme Court decision from 1872 called the Slaughterhouse Cases. Cases about a Louisiana law that gives a corporation in New Orleans the authority to regulate the slaughterhouse industry. There were concerns about sanitation in New Orleans. People said that there were, you know, animal parts floating in the river and things like that. So that seems to be what motivated the law. That's at least the claim. But one of the things that it required butchers to do is to go to a particular building to slaughter animals, and they had to pay a fee to this private corporation to do that. And obviously that upset the butchers, who had previously, you know, been doing it in their place of choice, and they viewed this as an obstacle to them being able to practice their profession. So butchers in New Orleans challenged the law. They claimed that it violated their privileges or immunities protected under the 14th Amendment, that the New Orleans law violated that right. And the court rules that the clause actually protects only a very narrow set of federal rights limited to things like free access to the seaports or the sub-treasuries or the right to peaceably assemble, which at least is listed in the Bill of Rights, and the right to use the navigable waters. So these are kind of quite a distant thing from the list of rights that had been listed in Corfield. And the idea that the Privileges or Immunities Clause is the source of those broader rights has essentially been wiped out only a few years after it's enacted. That's why Professor Akil Maher, I think, rightly says that the slaughterhouse cases strangled the Privileges or Immunities Clause in its crib. But one of the dissenting opinions by Justice Stephen Field says that if the majority is right, the 14th Amendment was a vain and idle enactment, because there is a presumption in the 14th Amendment that individuals have a right to pursue a legitimate occupation, and this law was interfering with that.
Yeah, so slaughterhouse essentially pares down the list of rights which the 14th Amendment was meant to protect.
Right.
So I assume then that the courts have at least stood up for the very narrow understanding of privileges or immunities since that decision. Are our rights to use the navigable waterways secure? Please, John, tell me that my right to use the navigable waterways is secure.
I have another unfortunately not answer. So this is actually, to kind of prove that point, I'll give you one of IJ's cases. In 2011, IJ joined with two brothers, Jim and Cliff Courtney, in a lawsuit that was intended to protect people's right to use the navigable waters. It's like, okay, let's take slaughterhouse at its terms and say that is, you know, the Privileges or Immunities Clause is limited to these set of rights. Well, at least we can get a court to protect those rights. And Jim and Cliff wanted to start a ferry business serving Stehekin, which is this remote area in Washington State on Lake Chelan. But for nearly a century, a Washington law had required would-be entrepreneurs who wanted to potentially have a ferry business to obtain a certificate of public convenience and necessity. And the explicit goal was protecting current ferry providers from competition. It was a monopolistic and anti-competitive law. And so just to bring this back to the events leading to the enactment of the 14th Amendment, the right to use navigable waters was important to people's livelihoods. And prior to the 14th Amendment, Southern states had passed laws limiting freed blacks from exercising that right. For example, Savannah, Georgia had enacted an ordinance that prohibited free black men from piloting vessels on the Savannah River at the behest of white pilots in Savannah. There's another set of laws passed in the Southern states called the Negro Seamen Acts, which required ship captains to jail any free black sailors on board whenever they entered a southern port that had one of these laws. So you were a free sailor and you would go into one of these southern ports that have these laws and you're required to be put in a ship prison. And it was so that enslaved blacks in those states would not see or interact with free black sailors. So later, John Bingham, who's the principal architect of the Privileges or Immunities Clause, he actually references these laws during Congress's debates over the clause. So at the time of the 14th Amendment's enactment, the right to use navigable waters was connected to the right to earn a living. But back to the case in Lake Chelan, the Courtney's challenge to the Lake Chelan ferry monopoly went through several years of litigation in federal court, back to state court, back to federal court. And unfortunately, in April of 2020, a federal court of appeals held that the ferry monopoly does not impact the Courtney's privileges or immunities because it only restricts their ability to engage in intrastate rather than interstate or foreign commerce. So even the portion that survives slaughterhouse has been narrowed even more.
Wow. Okay. So in the case you just described, I think speaks to the role that deference to legislators has played in weakening the protections that that courts can offer those whose rights are being violated by government. So can you speak a little bit to that principle of deference that we call that rational basis review? Is that right?
Yeah. So a lot of what's relevant to rational basis review starts to change during the New Deal era. And prior to the New Deal, there's this really important case called Lochner versus New York. It is now considered a relatively notorious decision, but at the time it was considered pretty straightforward and not, it wasn't very remarkable. Now it's often discussed as if it's, you know, like Plessy versus Ferguson. It's usually put in that category of cases, which is kind of incredible because it was about a New York law that prohibited bakers from working more than 10 hours a day. That's what the case was about. And the law is challenged by bakers who do not want to be subject to this restriction. And the case gets to the Supreme Court. And the majority says in Lochner that there's not sufficient evidence that this restriction is aimed at a legitimate interest. But it's been passed for some other motive. It looks like a labor law benefiting special interests. That's arbitrary and it violates due process. And in a concurring opinion, Justice Marshall, he disagrees with the majority because he thinks that there is enough evidence, the law serves a legitimate interest, and he thinks that law should have a presumption of constitutionality. But that's pretty much his beef with the majority. He thinks otherwise. You know, we're using the same framework, I just came out the other way. But in a dissenting opinion, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. writes a dissenting opinion where he suggests that courts should defer to the, quote, natural outcome of a dominant opinion. And his view is basically that legislative will is supreme and that courts should essentially get out of the business of reviewing legislation to see whether it violated constitutional rights, to engage in an extreme form of deference. And then in one sense, you can kind of see the next several decades after Lochner as a debate about which of those three approaches should dominate. Which rights should the court care about? How closely should courts look at a challenged law? Should they defer or not? And towards the beginning of the New Deal, in a case called Nebbia, this is in 1934, the court looks like it settled on something like Justice Harlan's approach, at least in the context of economic regulations, there's a rebuttable presumption of constitutionality. So if plaintiffs want to prove their case, they can come forward with evidence to prove that there's not a legitimate interest. But by 1938, at the end of the New Deal, we get a big change that has lasting implications for deference and how courts look at legislation. There's a landmark case called United States versus Caroline Products. It has the most famous footnote in American legal history. In footnote 4 of the decision, the court essentially creates a hierarchy of constitutional rights, and only two kinds of laws will receive heightened scrutiny, which is essentially what they're saying is real scrutiny. Laws restricting rights listed in the first 10 amendments. So as you're talking about before, now there is a distinction between enumerated and unenumerated rights. So the rights that are enumerated will get heightened scrutiny, and laws that restrict the political process. So like laws targeting religious, national, or racial minorities. Those are the fundamental or core rights, and everything else, especially laws that limit people's economic rights, will receive rational basis review. A rational basis review, initially, like I mentioned before, it included this presumption that you could overcome. You could show evidence to establish that a law was not actually based on a legitimate purpose or achieving that purpose. But in 1955, rational basis becomes an extremely deferential standard. In a case called Williamson versus Lee Optical, the court says that a law will survive rational basis if the court can come up with hypothetical justifications that the legislature could have relied on in enacting the law. And in 1993, the court, I would say this language goes even further. The court says that for plaintiffs to succeed, they have to negate every, quote, conceivable basis which might support it. And they say it's entirely irrelevant whether the conceived reasons were the actual reasons that motivated the legislature. So that decision was a couple of years after IJ was founded, around the time that IJ was founded then. Challenging laws that were subject to rational basis review were a bit of a fool's errand.
Yeah. So even though, oftentimes you hear partisans regularly accuse the courts of judicial activism. It seems like far too often the courts actually use a really soft touch when standing up for individual rights against legislators. Because of rational basis review, lawmakers could, you know, for example, and I'm just pulling an insane example out of the air, write a law violating the rights of a group of citizens on the basis that space aliens have arrived on Earth in invisible and undetectable crafts, and the Supreme Court would stand up for the legislators in that nonsensical example.
I really hope not, but it really does depend on which form of judicial review courts embrace. There really are, I think, two competing visions of what a court's responsibilities are. If we're talking about meaningful scrutiny where evidence or the lack of evidence matters, then you would be able to challenge something like that. You'd have the opportunity to prove that a law lacks legitimate purpose. If, however, judicial review just means that plaintiffs can only win by negating every conceivable basis, including justifications that the government hasn't even dared to argue because they would sound insane, you could very well lose still as a plaintiff because, you know, invisible and undetectable spacecrafts. It's a question of whether courts have to engage with reality when people's rights are at stake, or whether they can indulge in what are effectively fantasies.
Gotcha. Yeah. And for those who haven't heard Bound by Oath yet, that's an example that actually showed up in questioning, I think, in a Supreme Court case where it was argued that, in fact, that would be subject to rational basis review. Okay, so 14th Amendment also speaks of the equal protection of the laws and due process. So it sounds like, you know, largely the Privileges or Immunities Clause it sounds like it's strengthened a little bit, but it's largely been, I think at one point someone said in Bound by Oath, like almost like struck from the Constitution in a way because it just doesn't mean anything. So how about equal protection of laws, due process, have those also been gutted by judicial precedent, or do they offer us some protection from bad state actors?
Yeah, so I think it's best to start with a bit about the meaning of each of them and then kind of answer what's left. Sure. What's left of them. So to start with equal protection, it was originally understood as a requirement that the government's protection from both government and private violence is applied equally. So for example, in 1871, a representative explains that it's effectively a denial of equal protection if officers charged under the law refuse to extend protection. But that's not really how courts go on to interpret the Equal Protection Clause. It kind of becomes an anti-discrimination principle, just like a generic anti-discrimination principle, a protection against laws that treat two people differently. And what that's led to, or at least what it led to for quite a while, is an emphasis on formal neutrality, regardless of its actual impact. So a good example is Plessy versus Ferguson. And in that, that's like one of the most famous cases at the Supreme Court. It's where the court held that a Louisiana law that banned black passengers from riding in white designated rail cars didn't violate equal protection because the law also banned white passengers from riding in black designated rail cars. So in essence, the court was saying, well, you don't really have an equal protection claim because you're both being treated the same way, even if the way that you're being treated is extremely poorly. It's almost like an emphasis on like a procedural nature instead of a substantive right. And Plessy is later overturned by Brown versus Board of Education. And today, the strength of an equal protection claim really depends on what level of judicial scrutiny applies. And so that's what I was talking before with this hierarchy that's kind of been created. If you're bringing a equal protection claim against a law, and that law is only subject to rational basis, it's going to be a very hard case to win. Whereas if you bring an equal protection claim and the law is drawing a distinction based on a suspect class like race or sex, you're going to have more heightened review. And so you're going to have at least an easier time winning, not necessarily easier, but easier than a rational basis. Due process has long been understood as a rule that essentially the government can't deprive you of life, liberty, or property arbitrarily. That's like kind of the background principle is arbitrariness. And to prevent arbitrary deprivations, your rights that fall under what the Supreme Court calls procedural due process, the right to notice, the right to hearing, the right that notice and a hearing will be meaningful. That's kind of its own box that's been created under due process. So a good example of those types of cases, there's one called Toomey versus Ohio, which is about this really weird Ohio institution called mayor's courts, where mayors actually sit as judges in small matters. And in Toomey, the mayor of that town received a $12 bonus every time that he found someone guilty. Not if they were found innocent, only if they were found guilty. So you can maybe imagine what kind of incentives that created. And the court recognized that your due process right to a neutral and detached decision maker is violated when the person judging your case makes money when they find you guilty. Another more controversial area of due process, this is kind of the other bucket of due process cases, is substantive due process, which is the idea that the deprivation of certain rights, kind of no matter the process that has been provided, are still unconstitutional. And those are usually cases that hinge on, is this a fundamental right or is this not a fundamental right? And many people believe that substantive due process is simply the result of the privileges or immunities clause being gutted, and that those sorts of claims that would have been made there have kind of found their way into due process. And just like equal protection claims, a substantive due process claim's strength is almost always going to depend on which level of scrutiny apply, whether it's rational basis, intermediate scrutiny, or strict scrutiny. And then to your question about whether equal protection or due process still meaningfully protects people, that's what it's going to depend on in each of those cases, is really, is the court deferring? And whether the court defers or not is usually going to depend on the level of judicial scrutiny.
Yeah, and that point you made about how due process has been kind of split, substantive due process, and then I think it's procedural due process. Is that correct?
Right.
Yeah, which is a confusing way to say it, because procedure just means process.
Right. But,
So procedural due process is actually about the process that's used when you're, you know, brought before court or whatever, as far as how your rights are protected or abused. And so the substantive due process basically says it doesn't really matter if you have a trial, it doesn't matter if whatever, if you're on trial for, you know, being gay or something, that's like just substantively, like that's not acceptable. So like you have a substantive right to not, regardless of the process, that's too much.
Right.
Right.
Okay. It's almost like the process cannot launder the fact that you have violated someone's substantive right.
Gotcha. Yeah, and when you spoke about Plessy versus Ferguson, I thought of a similar argument I remember hearing when gay marriage was debated before the courts kind of sided, took a stance on that, which was that, laws against gay marriage don't restrict the rights of gay people because straight people also can't marry a person of the same sex.
Right. These have actually been the kind of arguments that have been made in some pretty, I would say, heinous defenses of certain things. They're like many of the miscegenation laws were defended on similar grounds. It was, you know, we're not discriminating against black people because white people also can marry people of another race, you know,
right.
And that's basically used as a way to say, of course, there's no equal protection violation. You're all being treated the same.
Yeah. Which, I mean, from a libertarian perspective, I think what's so kind of disheartening about Bound by Oath, listening to it, at least that first season, well, also actually every season has disheartening things, there's so much assumption about what legislators are allowed to do, and there's very little of that, like what you might call the substance of due process stuff, because it's like, well, I mean, the state can, legislators can pretty much do whatever they want. Like, there's exceptions, but like there's just this such deference that's sort of put on what legislators can do, that individual rights just become just this, you know, you can write them on a smaller and smaller piece or a paper, piece of paper.
One of the interesting things, I mean, you mentioned this before, that there's, you know, people have a lot of concerns about what they call judicial activism, right? There's kind of a pendulum that you can imagine between judicial activism and judicial abdication. And kind of depending on what's going on in the world, the pendulum is swinging to one side or another, and people are making arguments about one thing or another, that courts are doing too much, courts are doing too little. But I think you're absolutely right that in the area of individual rights, I think what ends up being very hard, and this is why you end up with the constitutional hierarchy that I mentioned, people have favored rights. And I think that the problem ends up being that that people don't really take a principled stand on protecting all of the rights. They want to pick out certain ones. They pick out their friends, and then they want to protect those. They want courts to protect those. And outside of that, there's not much protection for the things that you don't really care about. And that ends up being a problem, turns out, because other people care about those rights. So there's ultimately pushback.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so another area that is discussed in the first season is the occupational licensing has been sort of unreasonably and unfairly applied, and how that has been attempted to be addressed by appealing to the 14th Amendment. Can you get into that just a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was, you know, I've just been discussing rational basis and things like that, and litigating rational basis, especially after you have courts talking about this conceivable basis standard, is generally a fool's errand. But that's a lot of our work, and it's hard, but we've had a lot of success. And occupational licensing is a good example of our work because it highlights why you need courts to be willing to take a close look at laws, even if those laws the court has often looked at economic regulation as if it's kind of not a big deal. It's just workaday economic regulation. But when you take a close look at licensing laws, you can find that they are violating people's right to earn a living. And that's often because they lack a legitimate purpose. Often they exist solely to protect industry insiders who have successfully lobbied to eliminate competition, or they just don't further a legitimate purpose. They don't actually achieve what they say that they're trying to achieve. And so I can give you a couple of good examples of this. One of my favorite IJ cases involves a successful challenge that kind of encapsulates all of these issues. In 2010, we represented monks at the St. Joseph's Abbey, which is a Benedictine monastery in Covington, Louisiana. And the monks there had been making handmade wooden caskets in late 2007 to support their education and health expenses. And they were selling those caskets for significantly less than you'd pay from, say, a funeral director, where caskets can be very expensive. But there is a Louisiana law which made it a crime for anyone other than a government-licensed funeral director to sell caskets, wooden boxes, to the public. And that was because the funeral director industry didn't want to compete with other people selling wooden boxes. And this was a purely protectionist, anti-competitive, monopolistic law. It was preventing people from being able to make a living by selling these things. And we won that case. The Fifth Circuit struck down Louisiana law under a rational basis review. So that's a good example of how licensing can be abused, but also how it can be fought. And we've also been successful in challenging other licensing restrictions on other grounds, trying to get out of the rational basis standard and into some other form of heightened scrutiny. And as we mentioned before, one of the ways to do that is to involve one of the rights that's actually enumerated in the Bill of Rights. So for example, on a behalf of tour guides in DC, we challenged a DC law that prohibited people from giving tours without a government license. And we challenged it as a violation of free speech. So these tours just involve people walking around the city, describing points of interest, cracking jokes, you know, like if you've been on a historic tour in a town, it is what it is. And this law prevented them from doing that without a license. And so we challenged that licensing restriction as a violation of the First Amendment. The case went up to the DC Circuit, and the DC Circuit struck down the law under the First Amendment. And that's an area of litigation that we call occupational speech. But both of those types of cases are really getting at the same thing, which is that there is some law, often one that is protectionist or monopolistic, or at the very least, not achieving what it aims to achieve, that is preventing people from earning a living.
Yeah, another example too of occupational licensing that I think IJ has been involved in that's sort of famous, at least among libertarian nerds, is the black hair issues, the braiding hair, right?
Yes, yep.
Go ahead.
the hair braiding issues are definitely an iconic example of this, and many of those cases involve people who immigrate from Africa. They do hair braiding. And they want to be able to offer hair braiding services for people in their communities, but then they find out that they can't do that without complying with this. Usually it's a crazy list of requirements. Often it's requirements about the actual space that they're doing the braiding in. Often it's education requirements. And this is where it gets really wacky, is many of the laws that we've challenged on behalf of the braiders, they're basically forced to go to a school, to pay a school to learn everything but hair braiding. And so that's kind of one of these examples of, you know, health and safety in the abstract is a legitimate thing for the government to be encouraging. But when you're forcing people to go to a school and pay a bunch of money and do a bunch of things to their store, when you aren't teaching them or helping them do anything, what you're actually doing is you're just putting a bunch of obstacles in front of them to being able to earn a living. And so our hair braiding cases are also a great example, because when we started doing it, there were quite a few states that required licenses for hair braiders. And as we've won these cases over and over again, that number is getting very, very small.
Yeah. And similar to the example of the funeral directors unions or whatever, you have the people who are really pushing for these kind of regulations and these laws are, of course, the cosmetology schools.
Right. People who benefit from other people being forced to attend their school, pay them thousands of dollars. It's basically just a protectionist law that makes sure that the government forces other people to keep you in business.
Yeah. I thought you were going to say protectionist racket, which is also what it is.
Yep.
So how can people follow the work of Institute for Justice and support it? And where can they find Bound by Oath, which just wrapped up its third season? I think season two was largely focused on qualified immunity and told stories that would make you go bald. At least that happened to me.
Yeah, me too.
And season three focused more on property rights. From season one is the 14th Amendment. So I'll repeat my question. How can people follow the work of Institute for Justice, support it? And where can they find Bound by Oath?
Yeah, so first of all, we are a 501c3, so donations are what enable us to exist and represent our clients at no cost to them. If you're interested in doing that, there is a link to support us on www.ij.org. You can also follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, X. I think we're even on TikTok these days. Those places are good to follow us if you want updates on our cases, cases that we're launching, what's happening in our cases, and other interesting things that we're doing. You can find Bound by Oath and our other podcasts on our website. You can also find them on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and Amazon Music. And if you really like us and you want to support us in another way, you can also come work for us. We have a lot of openings, including openings for attorneys, law students who want to come do the litigation fellowship like I did, law students who want to clerk for a semester, and a bunch of different internships for college students. And you can find out more about that at ij.org/careers.
Yeah. And I didn't realize that you guys had a TikTok. I don't use it very often, but I'll have to add you guys. I just got it just to spite Dan Crenshaw. But I do follow you guys on YouTube, and you guys post a lot of great videos there too.
Yeah. Our team on there is amazing at telling the stories of our cases through those videos. I highly recommend going and checking some of those out.
Awesome. Thank you so much, John. I appreciate your time today, and I encourage everybody to listen to Bound by Oath and support the Institute for Justice.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Libertarian Christian Podcast. If you liked today's episode, we encourage you to rate us on Apple Podcasts to help expand our audience. If you want to reach out to us, email us at podcast@libertarianchristians.com. You can also reach us at LCI Official on Twitter. And of course, we are on Facebook and have an active group you are welcome to join. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Libertarian Christian Podcast is a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute, a registered 501c3 nonprofit. If you'd like to find out more about LCI, visit us on the web at libertarianchristians.com. The voiceovers are by Matt Bellis and Catherine Williams. As of episode 115, our audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.
Hello, everyone. It's Doug from the Libertarian Christian Podcast. You might notice already that this recording sounds quite a bit different from usual. In fact, it probably sounds pretty crappy. Well, I'm doing this to show you something pretty amazing. As you might know, the guys over at Podsworth Media have been producing my show for several years, quite a while, hundreds of episodes. And now they have a brand new online app for taking rough recordings like this one and making them sound a whole lot cleaner and a lot more listenable in just a few easy clicks. So here are some of the core features. They remove background noise. It reduces plosives, which is really handy for me because I often forget to put my pop filter on before I do a YouTube video. Because pop filters look terrible when you're on camera. It fixes clipping. It removes clicks and pops. It evenly levels dialogue so that you don't have somebody talking really quietly. And then somebody talking really loud because they're too close to the mic or too far away from the mic. How do you use it? It's easy. You go to podsworth.com, you click get started, and because you're a listener to one of the Libertarian Christian Institute's podcasts, you can get 50% off your first order by entering the promo code LCI50. That's LCI50, and you will get 50% off your first order. If you are doing anything like a podcast, a video, a sermon, an audiobook, anything that's spoken word, you want to use podsworth.com and clean up your audio to be even more professional and polished.